Welcome to Constitution Avenue, a new podcast where we dive deep into the week's hottest news topics, from the halls of Congress to the Oval Office. I'm Nathan Worcester, and these are my co-hosts, Jacob Berg.
Hi.
And Sam Dorman.
Hello.
Plus, Epoch Times journalist Stacey Robinson joins us to talk about the new Chicago-born Pope, Leo XIV.
Good evening.
We'll talk more about that at the end of the show. Today, I'm reporting back from President Trump's favorite place in North America that isn't America, Greenland. We'll also cover a major new UFO development, as well as birthright citizenship in the Supreme Court. It's been a big week in the news. The United States and the world are on edge as two nuclear-armed neighbors, India and Pakistan, veer closer to war. If you want to hear more, check out Roman Balmakoff's breakdown of the conflict on Facts Matter, linked in the show notes. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has restricted funding for gain-of-function research. Check the show notes for Joshua Phillips' reporting on this news for Crossroads. Now let's zoom in on our topics. I cover energy and politics, and Greenland brings the two together. I visited the territory this week to get a closer look at a place that has dominated the headlines. But first, some context. It's been months since President Donald Trump renewed his first-term talk of adding the Danish territory to the United States. He seems pretty serious about it. On May 4th, Trump was asked if he would rule out military force to take the world's largest island, which already hosts an American space base. Here's what he said.
It could happen. Something could happen with Greenland. I'll be honest. We need that for national and international security.
But not
I think
Canada.
It's highly unlikely.
The president has two big reasons to acquire Greenland. One is its strategic location. The other is its mineral deposits, especially rare earths metals. China currently dominates the mining and processing of those critical minerals, which are used in defense systems and other tech. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Trump administration is stepping up spying on Greenland. Denmark's foreign minister said he intends to call the U.S. ambassador about it. But the geopolitical wrangling is just part of the story. Greenland's politicians claim to want independence, but a March election seems to have pushed back any bid to leave Denmark, at least for now. If Greenland were to become independent, it would be that much closer to joining the United States. Dig a little deeper, and there's a lot more to the story.
I've been developing these big projects in Greenland. Why? Because we have to strengthen the economy. We have to generate revenues in other sectors than in the fishing sector, because 98% of our export revenues derives from the fishery.
That was Sven Hardenberg. He's a Greenlander who has partnered with an American, Drew Horn, on efforts to develop rare earth resources, as well as a seaweed plant. In Hardenberg's view, a larger, more diverse economy will help Greenland make its case to go its own way.
That's interesting. Is that something that a lot of people in Greenland agree with?
Well, here's what I heard from Paku Larsen in Nuuk.
Yeah, the Nathan Reason is on the way to independence.
I spoke to her on the boat where she works as a tour guide, showing visitors Greenland's natural beauty. Fjords, icebergs, the occasional whale.
That's all office here.
The office.
She too hopes Greenland's economy can be strengthened, in her case through tourism. But she and Hardenberg see rare earths differently.
Hopefully, there won't be any minings very long time. We want to keep the nature as it is.
Larsen thinks most Greenlanders agree with her on that, and she believes independence will take decades. Of course, another strike against large-scale mining is that some revenues might not go to Greenland. Above 75 million Danish kroner, about $11.3 million, half the revenue would go to offsetting Denmark's block grants to the island. That block grant makes up about 50% of the Greenlandic government's revenue. There was pro-independence energy at Nuuk's Fight Club, a boxing event that gives troubled kids an outlet for their aggression. Before the young people sparred, an all-ages crowd stood for the Danish and Greenlandic anthems. The latter got a lot more cheers. One man at the event, Jacob Trondheim, doesn't expect independence to come quickly. Here's what he said.
We will do it someday. Not 10 years, maybe 20 years, I don't know.
While Trump has said he wants Greenland for safety, Trondheim pointed out that American troop numbers in the territory have decreased over the decades. Yet he sounded positive about an expanded security role for the United States.
Wow, Nathan, that sounded like a really interesting trip and a great experience as a reporter. Do you have any highlights from it?
Well, you know, there were a lot of moments. It's hard to choose, but I think that the cab ride from my hotel to the airport with another Epoch Times reporter and photographer, John Fredericks, stands out. The cab driver was on the younger side, and he told me that there's a pretty big generation gap, which is in line with what I'd heard from other people on the ground, and that the younger generation, they tend to be, if not in favor of Greenland going to the United States, at least much more serious about independence. The older people tend to be more committed to Denmark. One line in particular really stuck with me. He said that there needs to be a kind of a moving on from the past, and that the status quo right now with their economy and their reliance on Denmark just is not sustainable. I guess we'll see if that aspiration can turn into reality. And now let's hear from Jacob Berg, who is a bit of a UFO enthusiast. Jacob, I bet this was a pretty fun story to work on.
It really was. Thank you, Nathan. I cover aviation and national politics, especially the executive branch. But today, I'm excited to be talking about something a little bit different than usual. As many of you already know, I love to discuss things in the sky, be it airplanes, drones, or even spacecraft. Well, what many of you may not know is that a few years ago, when the Pentagon UFO videos were released, I took an active interest in the government's investigations into the phenomenon, which go back to the 1940s. Last week, Representative Luna made a post on X pointing out a new centralized hub on the National Archives website that features thousands of publicly available government UFO documents. Although the Pentagon now calls them Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, or UAP, personally, I'm not going to stop calling them UFOs, no matter how hard the Department of Defense tries to push their rebrand. Famously, those documents include the Air Force's investigations into UFOs that eventually took on the name Project Blue Book. Those of you out there who have gone down the UFO rabbit hole like me know, at one point, that was also called Project Sign and Project Grudge. Anyway, that effort would go on to investigate thousands of UFO reports from Americans of all walks of life, including law enforcement and even government officials. But one major case spanned nearly a week across southern Michigan in 1966. Interestingly enough, it involved then-Congressman, you heard it right, Gerald Ford, who would later become president, and Hillsdale College, which has been in the news a lot lately. And lastly, also a farm that was just a few miles away from the property I would eventually grow up on decades later, and oddly enough, across the street from the church I attended in elementary school. So, if you've ever heard the term swamp gas in relation to UFOs, especially in Will Smith's running gag in the 1997 movie Men in Black, it came from that event in southern Michigan. Law enforcement officers and nearby residents claimed they saw a strange saucer-shaped craft with blinking lights land in a farmer's field in Washtenaw County before similar lights were reported by students at nearby Hillsdale College. Now, eventually, an Air Force investigator would hand wave multiple reports as mere incidents of marsh lights or swamp gas, leading Gerald Ford to step in and call for a formal investigation. Frustrated with the military dismissing state officials and members of the public, especially in his district. If you want to learn more, I definitely recommend you read the Project Blue Book case file, which catalogs some of the incredible eyewitness accounts. Now, after learning two of my aunts had claimed to witness these lights that week in 1966, which was a shock to me, I had even more inspiration to explore the topic. This week, I spoke with former pilots and aviation experts about hundreds of reports the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, compiled between 2007 and 2024 from various pilots, both commercial and non-commercial alike. As many of you can imagine, a lot of these are not particularly interesting, often attributed to, you know, balloons, satellites, or other airplanes. But some seemingly defy conventional explanations, and according to several aviation experts, pose serious concerns to national and public safety. One report described UFO strobing in a racetrack formation near Reagan National Airport in DC before disappearing minutes later. Last year, the Pentagon released a report on government contractors seeing a large metallic cylinder the size of a commercial plane just hovering stationary in air in broad daylight before it suddenly disappeared. Pilots told the FAA they saw a long, cylindrical object passing right over their aircraft in a separate report.
Is it a similar object? Unfortunately, we will probably never know. In 2022, multiple witnesses from Toledo to Detroit said they saw a UFO maneuvering aggressively in multiple directions and at varying altitudes between 29,000 and 100,000 feet. Just 1 month later, a caller told the government they saw an amber glowing sphere moving rapidly from the ground before stopping midair and ascending straight into the atmosphere. Not all aviation experts agree on the veracity of these reports, however. 2 weeks ago, when we spoke about aviation safety on the podcast, we heard from Shem Malmquist, a 40-year veteran in the industry. At the time, I asked him what he thought about pilots reporting UFOs, and he offered a skeptical take.
Some really cool optical illusions. The thing is that our brain just did not evolve to be in that kind of environment. Maybe like your perception, your space, your distances, heights, altitudes, it's just all just outside of what your brain, how your brain processes information.
He said pilots are not trained on visual perception.
So one of the problems that we have is that you have like airline pilots or military pilots, they are not trained on visual perception or looking at the different things. So, I mean, they're trained on a very specific task, but they're not able to see this kind of thing. And so they'll look at something and they think they know what they're talking about. They think they understand it, but it's just not their field.
We also heard from Richard Levy, another multi-decade veteran of the industry and a former commercial pilot. He said that while he has never personally seen a UFO in the countless hours of flying jets across the Atlantic Ocean, he supports the pilots reporting the phenomenon.
I stand by them. If they're attesting that with their sensory, what was called eyeballs and judgment, that they see something that they can explain, some aircraft, some light, that makes no sense to them, and the controller does not have any traffic to explain that, then I support what they're saying, that they're explaining well what they saw. Now, what they saw, that's a different issue, but I stand by what they say.
A new voice this week is Sean Prujnicki, an aviation professor at Ohio State, former NASA contract research engineer, and former commercial pilot. Along with former Navy F-15 pilot Ryan Graves, who many of you may have already seen on Joe Rogan a few times, Prujnicki reviews pilot UFO reports and has seen some he says that are truly incredible. Some have been tracked on radar moving upwards to Mach 30, which is significantly faster than any vehicle or aircraft on Earth. Prujnicki agreed that pilots are not trained on visual illusions, but he emphasized that many pilots are well-equipped to distinguish normal behavior of existing technology from behavior that's either unexplainable or completely outside the realm of normal. Here's what he had to say.
We know what military aircraft can and cannot do to a limit. I mean, obviously, there's, you know, secrets, levels of, you know, potential performance and so forth. But a pilot is a pilot, and we know basically what airplanes, you know, vehicles can and cannot do. So it isn't always so much a matter of colors of orbs and these types of things, but rather simply the movements that the apparent vehicles are making is what makes them interesting. That so when we see like a description like that, where we see two things chasing each other, especially at high altitude, we understand the aerodynamics at high altitude, what makes that challenging. And we understand that all of a sudden to be able to just, turn on a dime, so to speak, and go straight up and disappear, that aerodynamically speaking, and from a human performance standard, that is extremely unusual and very, very unlikely. That humans do not tolerate that level of G loading, and nor do we have anything that is, at least that we know of, that is capable of doing something like that.
So, I'm asking you listeners, what do you think about all of this?
Do you think these reports are nothing, potentially mere misidentifications or misunderstandings? Or do you think there's something here? Are we looking at secret U.S. military tech, incursions into our airspace from foreign adversaries, or something else entirely? You decide. Now, let's hear from Sam about some developments going on in the judicial branch.
Thanks, Jacob. I cover the Supreme Court, which is set for a big hearing on May 15th. The hearing is over some of the many legal challenges against Trump's policies. At the start of Trump's second term, he issued an order restricting something known as birthright citizenship, which is a concept that stems from the 14th Amendment. The amendment states in part, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States in the state wherein they reside. Historically, the executive branch has interpreted the 14th Amendment as granting citizenship to illegal immigrants' children who are born in the United States. Trump broke this longstanding practice, however, by saying instead that both the 14th Amendment and Supreme Court precedent didn't allow that. Instead, he decided that birthright citizenship shouldn't be given to someone if their mother was unlawfully present in the country and if the individual's father was not a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident at the time of the person's birth. He also excluded individuals whose mother's presence was lawful but temporary if their father was neither a citizen nor a lawful permanent resident at the time of the child's birth. As you might imagine, his order encountered a peppering of lawsuits and three separate federal judges blocked the policy. They did so through a highly controversial tool known as nationwide injunctions, which block a policy on a nationwide basis rather than just as it affects the parties before the court. On May 15th, the Supreme Court will likely not only consider the constitutionality of Trump's order, but also the legitimacy of these injunctions. It's the first hearing on one of Trump's second-term policies and offers the court a chance to wade into the debate over a controversial but growing exercise of judicial power. In contrast to usual Supreme Court hearings about the scope of the First Amendment and other issues, this one stems from a more preliminary appeal focused on procedural issues. The Trump administration has asked the justices to temporarily block the lower court's injunctions while the cases proceed through the court system. The administration could receive sympathy from both sides of the ideological spectrum. For example, Justice Neil Gorsuch has been critical of nationwide injunctions, but so has Justice Elena Kagan. While speaking at an event in 2022, Kagan said,
"And you look at something like that and you think, that can't be right, that one district court, whether it's in, you know, in the Trump years, people used to go to the Northern District of California. And in the Biden years, they go to Texas. And it just can't be right that one district judge can stop a nationwide policy in its tracks and leave it stopped for the years that it takes to go through normal process."
So what would the Supreme Court decide? That's always a difficult question to answer, but given the way this appeal was brought, it seems likely that they won't make a final determination about the 14th Amendment and who can receive birthright citizenship. Instead, they'll likely either uphold or remove the blocks lower courts placed on Trump's order. Hopefully, the eventual decision will come with some clarification about when nationwide injunctions are appropriate and when they're not. When courts decide on things like nationwide injunctions, they also comment on what's known as the likelihood of success on the merits. Basically, that means that when lower courts consider whether to initially block a policy, they'll consider how likely it is the other side will be successful in arguing that the challenged policy is illegal. That's where some of the more meaty constitutional arguments come into play. I spoke with Georgetown University law professor David Super, who said of the court,
"If they were to rule on this, there's a pretty good chance that even if it doesn't formally decide the merits, it will tell everybody who's going to win on the merits." Mm-hmm. And I think the court, quite rightly, is reluctant to issue a ruling that will effectively resolve the merits on a fairly major constitutional issue without hearing argument.
The justices will likely focus on what the 14th Amendment means when it says, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Democratic members of Congress have filed an amicus brief telling the justices that the amendment's plain language grants a broad form of birthright citizenship. On the other side, Republicans have said that being subject to a country's jurisdiction entails some kind of allegiance to that country, and that illegal immigrants don't actually have that. The Supreme Court has weighed in on this issue, but it was more than 100 years ago in a case called United States v. Wong Kim Ark. In that case, the court held that the 14th Amendment granted birthright citizenship to a Chinese man whose parents were legally present in the United States. The administration has said that the others are misinterpreting this case by extending the decision to children of illegal immigrants. So all in all, a lot of complex considerations for the justices, but it's great, I think, that they're holding a hearing amid all the lawsuits facing the administration. And I gotta say, as a former high school debater, I'm excited to see this debate unfold in real time. Meanwhile, in Rome, the white smoke has emerged from the Vatican, meaning a new pope had been elected by the College of Cardinals. Cardinal Robert F. Prevost, who was born in Chicago, is the new pope. He's decided to take on the name Pope Leo XIV. Stacy has some more information on that.
We have a new pope, and it's a very interesting thing because there are so many questions around that conclave to elect him. It wasn't really clear if it was going to be a long conclave or a short conclave, but it only lasted 2 days, I think.
I think a lot of people, especially those who are not Catholics, they're very interested in the fact that this is the first American pope. And I'm wondering, do you think that's significant? Does it mean anything, or is this perhaps overstated as an important aspect of the selection?
Well, the pope is from Chicago, and I think a lot of Chicagoans will probably be very sort of proud to have the first American pope come from Chicago.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah. That's right. Nathan's from Chicago. But I think in the overall picture, I think it's not really going to matter where he's from as much. I think that the real linchpin of this whole discussion is going to be, is he going to continue or will he divert from the things that Pope Francis did during his pontificate? Will he continue the Francis sort of push to politicize aspects of the Catholic Church and perhaps push it in a more left progressive direction? Or will he return to what almost all other previous popes did and focus more on Catholic doctrine, on spirituality, the love of God, and things like that? And the answer to the question of which way he will go is a great unknown.
Well, I'm personally also curious about what we can expect from the Pope when it comes to some of those divisive issues that are in the American system tied up in partisan politics. But again, I'm not a Catholic, but my understanding of Catholic social teachings is that it doesn't always cleanly break down into, one party, one side. It seems like on social issues, for example, he has more of what we would consider a conservative record, but on immigration and similar issues, he might fall more in the liberal camp. Is that accurate? And can you kind of walk us through why that might be?
I think that's a fairly accurate statement. He has the dubious distinction of being the first pope, I would imagine, in history to have hit pieces written about him within an hour of his election to the papacy. There are already articles that were posted talking about his quote-unquote anti-LGBT stance. And to be fair, in his attempt to uphold Catholic teaching, he did make statements that would be considered anti-LGBT, saying that Hollywood is perhaps trying to force that lifestyle upon people. In 2012, addressing bishops in Peru and saying that gender ideology should not be taught in schools because, quote, it seeks to create genders that do not exist. And these are things that the New York Times, when it reported about a week ago that he might be a contender for the papacy, a dark horse contender, to be fair, they quoted him saying some of those things. And so in that sense, I think that he would be considered more of a conservative pope, although those are really just teachings of the Catholic Church, neither conservative nor liberal. And from the other perspective, he posted a link to sign a climate petition on his Twitter. And he's also, I understand, he's criticized some aspects of the Trump immigration policy, although I don't really know the details about that enough to speak about it intelligently. So really, a lot of this comes down to not left or right, not conservative or liberal, but how much the new pope will cling to the teaching of the Catholic Church, or will he muddy the waters as some recent prelates and perhaps even the pope, the late pope, have done?
Was there anybody you thought would be a more likely candidate? I suppose he was a bit of a dark horse, wasn't he? He came somewhat out of nowhere, but others who you thought stood a better chance?
I heard his name mentioned. Like I said, just in passing, I glanced at that New York Times article, but didn't think much of it. A priest that I know who is a Vatican insider in the truest sense also mentioned him and said he was unlikely. But it's actually usually the unlikely candidate that's left. It's almost never the candidate that is expected. I think Pope Benedict might have been expected, but that's the last one.
I was curious to ask you that exact question, Stacey, as another non-Catholic myself. Was Francis considered a dark horse candidate at the time? Because it's I can't really remember.
Well, the voting in the conclave is supposed to be secret, but it almost always leaks, at least in the last 40 or 50 years. And so we know now that Francis, who was then Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio, he actually came in second to Pope Benedict in 2005. And without going into the whole can of worms involved in this statement, you can do your own research. That was partly due to a cadre of very progressive, heterodox cardinals, bishops, and priests who referred to themselves as the St. Gallen Mafia because they met in St. Gallen, Switzerland. And they had a plan to install Bergoglio as Pope in 2005, which failed. But then when Benedict resigned in 2013, they saw their chance and they managed to install him at that time.
Do you think that something like Pope Francis's measures related to the Latin Mass, that will be maintained? Or do you think there's any chance of different policy?
That's a really tough question to know. It's unclear exactly how the new Pope himself feels about the Latin Mass. However, we do know that he was in charge of appointing bishops around the world, and he would have been the one responsible for stripping Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, of his bishopric, which reportedly, again, these are difficult things to nail down precisely because it's all based on inside information from the Vatican. But supposedly that was because he disobeyed the order to cancel the Latin Mass at his diocese, as many other bishops did as well. But maybe because he was more vocal about it on Twitter and because it was a smaller diocese, he did not get away with it. And he was removed from his diocese, reportedly, by Prevost when he was in charge of appointing bishops around the country, around the world, really.
That's very fascinating. I think that we'll all be looking to more of your reporting and other Epoch Times reporters covering these issues over the next few weeks and months, because certainly the notion of an American Pope, one who we might see as a continuation of Pope Francis, but also at a time when I understand it's not just about partisan politics, but he certainly seems to be a figure in a kind of counterpoise to President Trump, who's so hugely influential and against whom the new Pope has spoken out on social media. I'm sure that people, Catholics, non-Catholics alike, will be very interested in seeing what continues to develop here.
That remains to be seen, I think. But we're definitely going to be keeping our eyes peeled and to look and see what he says in the next coming days, weeks, months.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for listening to Constitution Ave with Nathan Wester, Jacob Berg, and Sam Dorman. Join us again next week for the most intriguing topics in news and politics.